Jim Harries. I've often played this game of parallel universes and wonder what the world would be like if Jim wasn't around. A lot less work, certainly, over the last few months and this weekend. When we went into conference for the committee organising this conference, it seemed the bar got a little bit higher each time and the problems a little bit more difficult. But here we are, and we think we've solved all the problems. But have we solved all the problems relating to Vulnerable Mission? I think every time I've gone into Vulnerable Mission, I found the problems a little bit more difficult. But anyway, I think the important thing is it's producing a missions paradigm that's getting people to think. And even if they don't agree, it's good for them to get a bit self-critical about themselves. And we hope that this will lead somewhere positive, and that one day we'll be able to say that Vulnerable Mission is a more mainstream form of mission, at least those of us who agree with Jim. So may I introduce Jim, and can you set us thinking, Jim?
Thank you very much, Tim. For the welcome to share in this session, and for everyone else who's contributing in so many ways to this conference. One thing I want to say I admire Gene for, sticking to our guns. One thing that strikes me, I can be in Kenya or in Tanzania, these issues are critical. And you get back to the West and people say, it doesn't really matter, does it? It's not really important, is it? I mean, it's okay if we do this. It's all right if we do that. And when you get to the West, everyone wants to damp this down. We're the people, folks. Really doesn't matter so much what they're doing over there. We do mission to them. And when I'm in Africa, I'm thinking, I've got to get this message to folks. Goodness, how come they're doing this all the time? Don't they see what the consequences are? So, bit of introduction. I want to go quickly. Now, I was missed out in telling the story for some reason, but I'll go quickly through my own story here. Western Kenya, lie the land for a long time. I taught at KIST, Kima International School of Theology. Now my office is there in the Coptic Orthodox mission, 7 miles from home. I usually travel by bicycle or bus. There's my home from the air. No, I wasn't in a helicopter, but Google Earth enables this kind of thing. Various folks here have been to visit me, so that's great. More a welcome. I do look after children at home. I usually have 10 to 12 children, essentially orphans, who I informally adopt. And here's my home from the ground. At home, I don't have electricity and running water, so I don't have things like microwaves and computers and fridges. For various reasons, one being I don't have electricity. Others being because if I had such things, it would attract thieves. And I don't attract thieves to where there are children. And neither do I want to have walls and fences and watchmen. Also means that folks coming along walk in, my home looks like any other home in the village. This is built by an African man, the big house for his first wife, the other house for his second wife. So this is where I've stayed for the last 12 years or so. My ministry, I used to teach 2 days a week at a seminary, Bible college. Since 2011, I haven't been. Also used to have extension TEE teaching, where I opened classes. More recently, instead of opening classes and saying, come along, folks, what we've been doing is I go to people's gatherings. So the churches have their fellowships, their meetings, whatever they are. I get to know folks. I say, can I come? Come any time. I call them, where are you going to be today? How long ago? And join in on their territory. They're in charge of the agenda. I share what I can about the hope that Jesus has put in my heart. Funerals, a key event in our community, seem to punctuate life. We kind of know that, but we don't realize what's actually going on. what does it mean when funerals punctuate life? And that's kind of what life's about. I do travel more widely, recently a month in Tanzania, visiting churches again, endeavouring to be an encouragement for all my own weaknesses. And here's the Coptic Orthodox Church. I'm not Coptic, but they were happy to give me a room in their compound where there is electricity and security. That's where I keep my computer. And it's been great to fellowship with people of Egyptian ethnicity, as well as with the African people who are working with them in the Coptic Orthodox Church. So here's what has already been on the displayed, and Jean mentioned it, but I think it is critical, so I want to go through this. I must walk away from there. Just in a bit more detail. The Alliance for Vulnerable Mission believes that some Western missionaries... Now, we're making this emphasis at the beginning because it's easy for people to attack vulnerable mission. They think, well, they're actually attacking what we don't do. So we're saying some Western missionaries. We're not saying everybody throw down tools, stop. Some. It's very, very hard to find a Western missionary in Africa who isn't rooting their ministry in Western language and or Western resource. In fact, I don't know if I know any. I only do it part-time. That's pretty serious. We're there taking the gospel always on the back of our superior economy and our superior scholarship. Is that the gospel? Serious questions, big questions that we need to be asking. Ministry. Essentially, well, lifestyle is important. We don't want to focus on lifestyle. How do you live? Do you eat ice cream? Don't care. When you minister, do you minister on the basis of outside resources? Well, you've got the car, you've got the donor, you've got the English language class, you've got the superior education, you've got the money. Or do you minister on the basis of indigenous resources? That, to me, is an important question. So if you have to live in a big house on top of the hill with five cars and a helicopter, it doesn't matter. When you go into ministry, walk out the door, catch a bus to town, minister with folks there on the level. It's kind of decency in many ways to do so. We're looking outside of the West now, folks who want to apply to the West, sure, I mean that's fine. And we're looking at two things. So we're defining vulnerability in terms of local language and local resource. So I mean vulnerable is a broad term, can be many things. We're defining it in a particular way, and this is how we're defining it. So whatever other types of vulnerability there are that may be important, this is the core of what we want to keep to. Luke 9:3, I don't want to take the time to make a total biblical exposition on this. I think the Bible speaks loudly when we're listening. He told them, take nothing for the journey, no staff, no bag, no bread, no money, no extra tunic. When Jesus sent out people to do ministry, that's the basis on which he sent them. Acts 22:2, I think I have. I'm getting quick in my neck here, yes. Paul accused, he's been mobbed. The soldiers take him up towards the fort. He says, can I talk to the people? They said, okay. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. When the people realized Paul spoke their language, suddenly they became very quiet. So, again, if you want to ask questions, we can discuss more on the biblical basis. And the knotty questions, people do have knotty questions because, of course, the scriptures say you should care for the poor. How can you if you're not giving them things? Those are the questions. If you want to ask those later, we'll see if we can address them. The goal, run alongside. And Jean talked about, be there to encourage, the people in what they're doing. Some talk of presence ministry. Yeah, you're there. It's a funny thing in Africa, the West has enormous impact. It's kind of running the whole shop. But you don't see a Westerner. The few that you see, you can't talk to. Too sensitive. You upset them, you undermine them, you'll threaten them. So be polite. Because they're banking on money's the answer. They're banking on it. They're gambling on it, let's say. Their eggs are in that basket. We said, perhaps money isn't the answer. All their eggs at risk. That's bad news. There's a conference happening. You're welcome. Don't need to show that one anymore after this couple of days. Resources. Sorry that it's being cut off on the left there. If you find my reading too academic, no excuses anymore. Jean's book is here. Bargain for 10 quid. Usually goes for 15 quid. Actually, it's dollars, but anyway. Introductory text of Vulnerable Mission. Short. People tend to say it's a hard read. Sorry for those who only like easy reads. 33,000 words, I think. Just going through. I mean, there's many ways of writing an introduction. Here's an attempt. Looking at the theory and looking at the practice. Collection of articles, the first two are particularly pertinent on language and on resources, also available at the back. And this one, Mike, who's here, reviewed it for me and made some nice comments, and then Ralph wrote the foreword. So this is really the conference book. And if anyone goes away without a copy, that's a shame. So do take advantage of those resources. Also, I guess many folks here are on the bulletin list, are on Pearl. We have a discussion forum called Pearl. Please do sign up on the sheet, and we send out a monthly bulletin to those interested where we try and put together the vulnerable things happening in mission, if you like. Okay, can we pray? Lord God, I just thank you for this opportunity of sharing this afternoon with those folks who brought here together. Thank you for the commitment and dedication that's demonstrated in people having left their homes, people having travelled a long distance, so that we can sit together and know better how to do your work around the world, how to be available in your service. Guide us, Lord, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Any questions for clarification? Well, what I thought I'd do at this point is ask for a couple of volunteers. If a couple of people volunteer, please, for a non-speaking part. Thank you, Mike. One more. Yes, please. If you can stand, if Jeff can stand on this side, and Mike can stand on this side, and the mic can be there, kind of picking up as much as possible. Perhaps these things are pretty easier to understand if we see them dramatically. Oh, Mike, can you see them? I'll show you one thing. You were paying for Manchester United. This man pays for we didn't realise he's come here to the conference. We thought he's all about ministry and mission, and he's actually also a fantastic soccer player. In fact, I talked to his mum, and she tells me how he used to be up when he was 2 years old. No, was it? Well, however old it was. He's fantastic. I tell you, folks, you ought to watch your TV more carefully, and you'll see. Absolutely right, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's good to get to know you. And glad that you are so good at soccer. Oh, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Yeah, okay. Nice to see you also. Having a sporting representation here. Wimbledon. Quarterfinals. 1954. No, was it 1994? Hey, anyway. He's obviously thinning a bit now, but he's was on the ball tennis player and knows tennis inside out. if you want to know which end of the ball is the front, ask him. Jeff knows. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we have these two sports folks here. Of course, football is better than tennis. Do you agree?
I don't agree.
No. Okay, so disagreement. Anyway, Mike, there's a match on over the weekend. Good match?
Excellent, excellent. I think we beat Norwich.
Impossible. Impossible. But while we play, can you just tell me what's happening? And so I can tell Jeff what happened in the football match. Okay, right, okay. So the forward ran with the ball, and even though he was chased him, he managed to kick it into the penalty area. And when it got in the penalty area, then it was headed and hit the crossbar. Wow, that's fantastic. So the tennis player was running down with the ball and got in into the front, and he hit the ball with a racket and it hit the top of the net. And when the ball bounced back from the crossbar, he headed it and he went into the net. And it was fantastic. Applause, please. A goal, a goal. When the ball bounced back, hit it again and it went into the net. And they started the play again from the centre. He kicked it and he dribbled it and he was running along and he passed it along to the left winger, and the left winger used his left foot and kicked it, but the goalkeeper had a fantastic save by jumping into the left corner of the goal. Wow. So he served, and after serving he ran and he passed the ball to his partner, and he was left footed, kicked it, and the other opponent jumped and the ball went into the net. Anyway,
strange game.
You've got it.
No.
There seems to be any difficulty, folks. What's the problem? Well, what I'm trying to do is trying to tell him how the game of football works. But you know, there was
offside, wasn't it?
The referee blew the whistle. What's offside in tennis? Out. It was off. He was out. Not saying it was out. The ball was out. When the ball goes into the net, we rejoice. Do we?
No.
Two different cultures. Now we're seeing them actively. A football culture, a tennis culture. We're trying to translate. What's happening? What's happening? I think confusion is an understatement. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think he's really getting it. Because the game of football isn't... He's not playing football.
No, doesn't play it right.
If you realise that, you become the professor of missions. I don't know if John's here. They're not playing football. That's sometimes what it's, you know, what we realise. When you've been in Africa 25 years, you realise they're not playing football. You got that. Now you can be a professor. What are they playing? What are you playing? I don't know. How do you translate? Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you very much. Applause for our professional sportsmen. If they were on the pitch, they'd be earning £1 million today. Instead, they've taken this opportunity just to hang around with us. What's going on? Any more thoughts? Let's just expand it a little bit. So football, of course, is Western culture, particularly British, also American. So forget about American football. Soccer is what we do in the West, and tennis, of course, they do in Africa. So we take football to them. And when they don't understand what we're saying, so we teach them football language. So now they're expected to report on the game of tennis using football language, And if they get it wrong, well, we say you're daft. You're stupid, that doesn't make sense. So they go to school for years and years to learn football language while they're playing tennis. And the Africans think, well, let's try and explain tennis in football language. And they struggle, and it doesn't work. So they give up and say, there's no point in trying to connect what we say about football to what we're doing about tennis. Just tell them what they want to hear. They want to hear about football match. We can tell them we're playing a football match, and when they come, we'll put on the boots. And then they'll be happy, and they'll keep sending us some money. There's times when translation just don't work, folks. So what are we playing at when we minister in English, and we listen in English, and we interpret in English, and we say, yeah, what's in African economics? Now, economics, I know, is coming up in this conference. There's an African economics. Is there? We tend to assume, of course, Africans are trying to maximize productivity as we are. Or they're trying to please the dead. And they're just playing a different game. Intercultural translation. I think there's three options. One, ignore. And this is a dominant one. Just ignore the fact there's anything different going on. Just pretend they're playing the same game. Just talk to them in English and they'll answer us back in English. Just ignore the cultural difference and maybe it'll go away. Or maybe the church over there, something that Jean told us about, is booming on the back of our prosperity. Oh, prosperity gospel is wrong. We have to teach against prosperity gospel in Africa. But that's the only thing we're ever teaching them in favor of. Prosperity gospel. Because anything else doesn't make sense. What we say doesn't make much sense, but it comes with money. So they say it and they get money. Well, that's what they're learning. So one approach to the fact that there are different contexts is just to use the same language. Second approach is to use a translator. I tell you, this is difficult if you're using the same language. This is difficult if you're using the same language. I'm afraid I've seen someone from the US, someone from the UK, someone from Kenya meeting, talking in English. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. My services are not usually required. If they're required for a while, before long you get hit if you sit in the middle. Don't get each other. So one way to try and overcome the difficulty is to have a translator. And if they're translating and the people speaking the same language, let's give you an example. John, we'll meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. Is that okay?
Africa.
Ah. So we have the man from Africa here. Peter, we'll meet together tomorrow at 10 a.m. So John says we'll meet at 8. I have to tell Peter at 10. Hey, why are you telling him 10? I told him 8. Get in the middle and you get splattered. Now, if you have two languages, it kind of helps because a translator can reveal things that might not be happening, but he also gets a bit tired from trying to explain to the football player why the ball going into the net is not good news. And he just doesn't get it. What's the third option? Two languages, folks. This is the way it's been done in all of history. Now, people look at Greek in the New Testament times and say, well, that was a lingua franca. And Greek was spread by wandering philosophers who went full body, full mind, and had by default to bring what they're saying into the context they're in. English is spread by computers and texts and publishing houses and machines and the internet, and it goes empty. It's a disaster. And it's a disaster that the Western world is paying for. The United Nations is paying for. The aid agencies are paying for. You try taking aid that's not in English. There's a point at which you have to impact the local people. I'll tell you what, it's English. You're the local person, you know English, you get the lion's share of the benefit of the aid that's being taken. Globalised education, I don't want to labour this too much. What's happening is that the West is subsidising an educational system for the rest of the world in English, which is like a big tree. That's a big shadow. And anything that wants to germinate under the shadow of the tree, now Mike might recognise a little thing there called SIL. Trying to germinate some sense out of local languages, but is shadowed out, shaded out. It's almost impossible to get education in East Africa other than in English. Certainly in Kenya. You're beating your head against a wall. People would much rather be educated in what they don't understand than in what they do understand and doesn't make them any money. Globalized education in English, subsidized by bodies such as the UNN, the World Bank, and whoever, where is it heading? Now, no, that's beyond what we're saying in Vulnerable Mission. I'm just taking the principles to their natural conclusion, if you like, and the failure to engage in people's mother tongues or people's own languages, and yet we believe in education, can be a dumbification. Any questions at this point? Okay, I may get maybe you're either disagreeing or overwhelmed. Could I have two more volunteers, please? Two volunteers, please. Sorry, I'll be nice to you. Two volunteers, non-speaking parts. Peter, thank you. Fred, John, thank you. Whoever. Thank you very much. I'm the missionary. I'm you. And you've gone to Africa. Hello, Pastor A. He's an African pastor. Hello, Pastor B. He's an African pastor. I've come from Norwich. Oh, where things happen, what counts. Hello, Pastor A. How are you doing?
Very well.
I'm from Norwich.
Oh. You want to teach at my church? I could bring some pastor.
Well, you're a bit forward. actually, I've come to learn from you. I've come to learn. Okay, I'm going to listen to you. Is it right if I walk with you? You know, we talk a bit and just get to know each other. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah, so yeah, I'll just get to know each other, yeah?
Okay.
I'm kind of with you and I'm listening. Now, what you do the first week, you don't give anyone any money, but then you get to know them. And then when you've built a relationship, you give them money. So John is patiently waiting for the week to go by when he gets some money. Anyway, John, well, I want to learn from you, of course. Mm. I'm learning from you. I've got an idea.
How long do you
want? I've got an idea. Yeah. What do you think if we did this? And we did this.
Yeah.
And those people, we asked them to do so on. And we brought them there. This would really help these people. It would really be good for them. And they would support it because this and this. And it would happen. And then it would really work out. So people in Norwich are ready to back this. Do you think we should do it? Do you think we should do it?
No.
I've spent years. I've been at UEA studying development. Do you realise that? I've been preparing, and I know this. You're saying no. You don't want me. You don't want to do it. No. Hello, Pastor B. How are you doing? Good to see you. I'm from Norwich. Yeah. So if I get to know you a bit, you're in this village, and that fella's in that other village, isn't he? Yeah. Okay. I want to learn from you. Yeah, I want to learn from you. So if I spend time. Now, I've got an idea. And then this, and there's people in Norwich who are going to pay for it. What do you think? Yeah, we'll do it. Wow, you're the kind of fellow I like. You're the kind, because you see sense. You're intelligent. Not like that idiot over there. Oh, your child's going to that school. Oh, well. I can make sure he goes to the school in town. Where they teach properly. And you said your mother's sick in the hospital. Bill, how much is the bill? We'll cover it. And of course you can't walk. You have to direct these projects. Do you want a Toyota or do you want a Land Cruiser? Toyota. Okay, Toyota. Idiot. So
obviously, yeah. I missed out on
the his church members are coming over here. You know, his wife's walking out with him. She says he's an idiot. He turned down all this money. working with resources. This pastor is the last time he's going to make this mistake. The next time a foreigner comes, the answer is yes. Yeah, you want to do that? Yes, yes, yes. Because if he says no, he gets the money, and his wife walks out on him, and his church members have gone over here. He's an idiot. But yet we say, you go to Africa and you listen to the people. You go to Cambodia and you listen to the people. Well, I'll tell you what the answer is from the people. Now, of course, it's not always quite so simple, but usually the answer is yes. Because you're loaded. And people say, I haven't got any money, I haven't got any money. But the money comes. And we want them to bear the burden. Well, I'll blame him later, by the way. When he's corrupt. In 5 years' time, he's corrupt because he spoiled my project. It would have worked, but for him. We'll be enemies. And but for the time being, all the folks have gone from his church to his. Thank you very much, Pastor. Thank you very much, Pastor. Resources. In mission. Right, there's more drama coming, folks. There's more drama coming. If we have resources, how do we know what's going on? How do we know that people are telling us the truth? And this scenario, it troubles us in Africa. It's, you know, it troubles a vulnerable missionary, because if you start to yourself not have resources, and the people with resources come, and you tell them the truth, the local people might not like you anymore, and neither will the donors, because you're telling the truth. Better not tell the truth, folks. Truth is just stupid. Just please the foreigner, and everything will be okay. Pastor A and Pastor B, please. Another two Pastor A's and Pastor B's to volunteer. Thank you, Fred, to be Pastor A. Do we have a Pastor B, please? Thank you, Daniel, for being Pastor B. Now, I work with Fred. We put the church roof on, didn't we? With help from Norwich. Yep. So, you know, we're doing fine, and there's the orphans project in the church. And it's kind of going okay. Yeah. So every week I'm in his church, and that's where I'm tithing. That's a fair amount, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, we get on very well. Oh, this Sunday I'm going to visit Daniel's church. Yeah, just to visit you this Sunday. Is that okay? Well, worship you this Sunday. You worried? Yeah, I'm just going to worship with you this Sunday. Okay.
I am younger.
You are younger?
Yeah.
He's worried. Fred's thinking, Jim gives us the equivalent of 10 salaries every week just in the church offering. If he goes over there and Daniel talks to him, and Jim might like Daniel more than Fred. Fred could be in deep trouble. Oh, so Daniel has two wives, does he? Oh, so he's a thief. Okay, so he always deceives people. And he only pretends to be a Christian. And their denomination worships the devil. And of course he hears about what he's saying about him. So what have I done? Two pastors who hate each other. Why? Because of me. Because I'm his friend, and then when I just threaten the friendship a little bit, he's got to be careful because he might lose me, and that just is unthinkable. So the best strategy is to make sure I know he's terrible, deceptive, worshipping of the devil. How to spread enmity. Go in with the money, and it just kind of happens. Thank you very much, Pastor B. Thank you very much, Pastor. There's one more coming, so it seems intermediate discussion doesn't come very live. So let's just do the last example. Two more Pastor A's and Pastor B's, please. Another Pastor A, another Pastor B. Even a Pastor S, doesn't matter. Or two folks who I'm trying to work out who I'm going to minister with in Africa, and I'm here from Norwich. Would you mind, please, Ralph? And John, please. Yeah, okay. So if John Ralph stand over here. Now, of course, you have to know who you're going to work with. You can't just work with any old body, can you? You suss them out first. So, John, yeah, okay, good to see you. I'm sussing you out, but you don't know that, really, anyway. Yeah, so just getting to know you. Yeah. Oh, did you hear about that road accident?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, in that nasty corner.
That car overturned, that lady was killed, and three people injured. It's a pretty, pretty sad event. Why do you think it happened? Okay, so it's a brake failure. Yeah, the Toyotas have a problem with the brakes, you know, these days. And also, the visibility is very poor on that corner of the road, yeah. And, you've heard about the lady over there, she's pregnant and very sick. Very sick. We prayed for her, but why is she so sick? Okay, septicemia. Yeah, and malaria. Septicemia and malaria. So the poor lady's sick. Yeah, thanks, John, for filling in on that. Hello, Ralph. Yeah, okay. Good to see you. You heard about that road accident? Person killed. Car came round the corner and overturned. And a number of injured. Why did it happen? No, you're the site. You don't speak, please. All make too many accidents. You're misleading the people. Okay. So his neighbor's wife was originally his wife, and now she was jealous of him. So he went and he planted some medicine on the side of the road, so that when the car comes around, because the medicine buried in the soil, the car had an accident. Oh, it's witchcraft. Okay. The lady, they said. She's pregnant and very... Any idea why? Her sister died before she ever married. Now, isn't that sad? She never had the privilege of being married. And so she keeps coming back and bringing trouble to her older sister who is married. So we need to slaughter a goat in order to pacify the spirit. You're a superstitious idiot. I can't work with you. Yeah, we'll work with you. I don't know what he's on about. He's superstitious and he's really
very
primitive.
Much so.
Well, we'll work together.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Ralph. Sorry about the put down. Now, what if everyone believes what Ralph is believing? But you needed to tell the truth. You have to learn what the white man thinks and tell him that's what's happening. Okay. Questions? Yeah, Tim.
Okay, so I'm very convinced by the arguments of Honourable Mission about language, about resources, about the difference between magic and our own particular way of looking at things. They're incommensurable. But let's imagine I'm a missionary, a young missionary, and I see the choices before me. I'm going to see the chance of going abroad with a lot of backup. The logistics will all be there. The alternative is to be a very special, focused sort of person, possibly very exceptional. Which way am I going to go? It may well be that I'm going to choose the former. And I keep coming back to this same problem. Although I like VM, I like what it stands for, I believe it's right, could it just be an ideal? Is it going to be a practical thing that people are going to take up? You get the point?
Yeah. This is something that a lot of folks are mentioning, and it is an important point. I think, I don't want to misquote Jean, but when young folk come to her and say, well, how can I minister in this way? Who will take me as a missionary on this basis? And it seems she draws a blank. They will. but it's a serious concern. Can we allow, like the white man, to in some ways take the standards of a black man? Now, the other way is okay. The other way is expected and admirable. When blacks come over here and do what we do, we think it's marvelous. When someone goes over there and does what they do, it's disgusting. It's terrible. It shouldn't be done. And I've already mentioned the fact that out there on the field, sometimes these issues are very sensitive with missionaries. Just try and suggest to your missionary colleague a way of being vulnerable, and you can seem to be threatening years and years of ministry. And they're writing the prayer letters back home. Ministry's going great, more people converted, more people baptized. That's no joke. Same applies to the nationals, of course. As I've tried to illustrate, if you're a national and the missionary comes, then you go against the missionary, well, you're a fool. You're going to lose out. Agree with them. Tell them they're wonderful. That's quite a predicament. And no-can-hear predicament. And so, indeed, some mission context agencies, some are looking at this, I think, very seriously. How can they bring weakness into the mission force in order to prevent these impact contexts? And they're struggling because I was hearing in America, the American church wants their mission to go strong. They want to know that they're succeeding. They want to know how many people they've converted. Their project is really going great. And if they aren't doing all those things, well, what are you doing? So there needs to be some great awareness of these issues in order for a mission agency to say, John is a doctor, Daniel's a church planter, and Fred is a vulnerable missionary, and we love him. We're not going to attack him. Now, if you read this book, this is why I try and articulate this relationship issue. The vulnerable missionary, in many ways, cannot get too close to the other missionary. Because let's say, Pastor Ray again, this man is ministering and funding and close to him, and then he says, well, as from next year, I'm going to cut my funding. And the people see me close to him, they think I'm the one telling him to cut the funding. So they're suspicious, I'm the enemy of the people. So me as a missionary cannot get too close to the donor missionary, or become the enemy of the folks who are there. What are we doing in mission? Playing money games, playing language games. Football and tennis aren't intercompatible anyway. You tell people they have to play football, they put on a football show, but they're busy playing tennis. I mentioned funerals. Funerals and pacification of the dead, if you want to use that term, is a big issue in Africa. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time. We've been put on a football show, but this is important, folks. You have to keep the dead happy. Jean.
Said One thing that gives me hope for the future is, you know, Gene talked earlier about globalization and how that's making the world smaller. And I'll talk more about this, you know, later, but 15 years ago, the only way to connect between Norwich and Kampot province in Cambodia was through CMS or some World Vision. And to be honest, I don't want to beat up on international NGOs. This isn't, you know, beat up international NGOs week, but an international NGO operates in a very competitive donor marketplace where dollars from all the churches in the UK can go to one of any 500 international NGOs that are working in Cambodia and in Africa. And so they have to advertise big impact for money. If you give £1, we can save 10 lives. You give £1, we'll ship $50 of medicine and we'll, you know, save 10 babies with AIDS. And it's a thinly veiled lie, basically. But we've done it to ourselves. We have created this, we perpetuated this lie ourselves. That cannot sustain itself. The world is getting smaller. Missions is being democratized, where you don't have to have CMS to make a connection between here and there. People are doing it themselves over Skype, over Facebook. The reality is different. And as the world gets smaller, churches who were once removed and insulated from the reality of what's going on in Africa, that's coming closer. There's still a big gap, don't get me wrong, but that gap's getting smaller and smaller. And so I think just because of globalization, with all the problems it's bringing, it's also bringing an opportunity for the church in the West to grow up in a way that they haven't had to before, to be challenged with the reality of how God grows his kingdom and how money isn't the answer in a way that they haven't had to be challenged before.
Again, just following on a bit from what John is saying, one of the problems, I think most mission agencies are aware of most of the problems. That's my feeling at the moment. But it is this problem of individual churches and individual groups who go to do mission on their own back without the expertise of the agencies who can actually warn them about dangers and so on. And that's a group of people, I think, that we need to actually somehow get into. I'm not sure how we do it, I'm not sure how we get the message to them, but I think we have to do that.
Thank you. I mean, one thing about some of the agencies, the reason they can't speak also is because they're doing the same thing, unfortunately. There are many mission agencies in Kenya who function in English, and they're donors. So if the short-term team comes, they say, well, we can do this as well as you can. And in a way, they're absolutely right. Now, if those agencies were not using outside resources and using only local languages, the short-termer wouldn't have a foot to stand on. But the agencies, you know, that ominous thing is making the mistake as well.
I'm not very experienced in any of this stuff, so please forgive me if I ask a question that people go, whoa, really? How dare you ask a question like that? We seem to be talking about, the problem seems to be the fact that we're talking about us, Westerners, being in an alien environment. In a foreign environment, and therefore, you know, not exporting our culture to them, and them relying on us with our resources and everything else, is a better scenario for the indigenous people to be doing what the Westerner is trying to do over there. So in other words, you've been working in Kenya for 20 odd years. Therefore, I'm assuming that you have got something which, even after 20 years, the local people still haven't got. But what you're offering is valuable to them and all that. Is there a way of getting, of you being replicated amongst them, or is that not even what we're trying to do? Should there be, in their own context, people that are doing you out of a job? Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I mean,
what I'm hearing, if I do my job in such a way that local people can do it, and this is Jean's point again, then it's possible for it to be multiplied. So if I do it without drawing on outside resources, then local people who don't have outside resources can do it. And if I do it in their language, again, those who don't know English can do it, which is what Vulnerable Mission is saying. By being vulnerable in this way, you're setting a role model that can be imitated.
If I step back one step, you got what you've got, the abilities and the gifting that you've got. You got through an education in this country, through some kind of, you know, call it privilege or whatever. Is there a case for taking people out of their environment, using Western resources maybe, to bring them to an area where they could learn what you've learned, to take back, to multiply what you're doing, but already with the language, with the culture? So in other words, you know, could someone from your area of Kenya come over here and in a few years learn to do what you're doing? And actually, would that be a quicker way to replicate what you're doing than you doing it there in the United States?
Right. When you do that, you shift the problem. You shift the problem to someone else. And again, Jean's example of the evangelist who comes and you say, well, was it today? Was it somewhere else? Where'd you get the motorbike? You know? If you ever pay an African evangelist, people, well, he's paid. Well, I'll be saved as long as you give me something, but I'm not going to get saved for nothing. So saved church must receive outside funds to help the people, and they keep getting saved. But then it's foreign.
Because you did so many skits here, like the recorded one, but what happens if we take somebody out of their context to train them here? They play football, soccer, or they play tennis here. We bring them here and we teach them football, soccer. And then they go back and try to play soccer, but everybody else is playing tennis. So then they're not effective anymore in their own culture. So that's often what happens. And I would hope that, Jim, while you're working in Kenya, that you're not using everything you learned here, and not he doesn't just take whatever he learned here and then put himself into Kenya and then do everything that he learned there, but rather he learns to contextualize and make himself like them, so he's communicating incarnationally.
I mean, the other part of what I perhaps didn't say, what do we have that's of value? Jesus says, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you can move mountains. Because he realized people don't have much faith. And if you have backing and funding and all this, again, your faith is hard to see. Can we demonstrate faith? Frankly, that's what's valuable. As Jean said, a lot of what I've found valuable about my education, it's told me what I don't know. But the education tells you things you know so you can pass them on. Well, we have the scriptures. Yeah, the scriptures need to be learned. And even if they're learned in English, people get that knowledge of the scriptures. But in the meanwhile, all these other things are being fed in at the same time. Do you believe in Jesus? Can you demonstrate that over there? It's not easy. People aren't stupid. They don't, you know, short-term team comes for a week and sing beautifully. Well, they sing beautifully, but then they hear stories. Well, the girl who sung so beautifully got pregnant when she got back home. Oh, well. Takes a bit longer than a week. Do we have faith? Can we share our faith?
And going back to your last sketch, I was wondering if you could elucidate more about the difference. Is there a difference between the Vulnerable Missionary approach to indigenous beliefs and the traditional missionary approach?
Right, well, I mean, that was illustrating the fact that we select those people who think like us. I work a lot with indigenous churches, and I haven't really talked about that today. They do things that some of us think are wrong, so maybe you shouldn't work with them. But then if you find the churches that do what's right, they're all getting money from overseas. So why are they doing what's right? And ironically, the churches who do what's wrong can actually be stronger because they don't have money thrown at them. If you have money thrown at you, can be quite divisive, even for a church in the UK. Let's say NCBC, let's say you came and you offered £5 million to this church.
He just said to the pastor and the elders, £5 million, do what you like with it. We will create a lot of strife. They may get through it, they may not. The church might split, they might fight. We want to do this, we want to do that. So, in other words, Orthodox churches are constantly kind of under attack. But the unorthodox can actually build some indigenous strength. That's ironic. Right. The danger of engaging with indigenous beliefs is that if you're not careful, you go back home and people tell you you're wrong. It's in my own mind, I see things that are obvious. Someone's very sick. I know what they need. Now, it's indigenous. You know, you say they need malaria medicine. But that thinking is just so prevalent. We know how these illnesses arise, and it's not biomedical. So is that just some nonsense that a missionary must get disavowed of? In the modern paradigm, yes. But philosophically, we're no longer in the modern paradigm. I mean, things are shifting in the West, and there's a lot more attention given to, what do they call it, postmodernism and obscure practices, relationship with the dead, I'm sure, are amongst them. That's where the gospel really speaks. In a context where people become dominated by the dead. And the dead sometimes play jokes on us. They're not always nice to us. And then God loves you, you know. I don't know if I answered your question. If not, re-ask otherwise.
Jim, I think just following through that, I think one of the questions we possibly need to actually ask is, what is it that we're taking as the gospel? Because I think over recent years, we have confused the gospel with development. And it is usually development things which take the money and which actually cause the problems. That I think we've got to actually work out. A lot of people think they're doing mission when in fact they're doing development, and mission doesn't get done.
Well, interesting, I was talking with Steve, who's doing a course on mission and development. And the comment I made to him, we were talking, well, that's like mission in context. Because instead of doing just this is the gospel, he's also doing anthropology. But the context is one, then where he's comfortable. Because if you have to develop those people, you need the resources, so you need the infrastructure. Like if I'm doing development in this village, I need a vehicle because the donor wants to come and visit the project, and they're not going to walk. They're not going to ride in the local bus. So then I need a nice house and a vehicle, and development enables me to investigate the culture from a position of strength and not having to be engrossed in it. And I guess what Western missionaries haven't wanted to do is actually to get into the African culture without all that insulation that comes when you do it through development. So will the new generation be different? They're running for development and they're attaching the gospel. It's much safer that way. You don't really get hurt and you don't get exposed. You're not so vulnerable.
But I think that we don't actually present the gospel of repentance and forgiveness and the work of Jesus sufficiently, because we present the gospel of you come this way and you will be materially helped, your education will be developed, your potential will be developed, but we don't actually present the change of heart which comes through the relationship with Christ. And I think that's where we've got to be very careful.
Right, I mean, it's always nice to buy a set of friends, because then you've got people you can walk with and talk with, and they're like you, and they'll spend time with you, and so on. But to actually try and share the gospel, they might not want it. You may be useless. You know, if someone from Norwich was to go into, say, a Western Kenyan village and cut all links, you're about the most useless potential slave in the vicinity. You don't know the language, you can't dig, you can't build a house, you can't even go hunting. you know, a slave is a slave and you can have him do something useful, but you, what can you do? It's a bit rough as a missionary to realize you're worse than useless. And if you didn't have that lifeline, you'd be the lowest of the slaves in that community. Now, we're not actually saying in the Alliance of Vulnerable Mission that you shouldn't keep yourself. It's an admirable aim. That's where we should be heading to. Like a missionary from Africa coming to Norwich, if they're still getting the money from Nigeria, we question what's going wrong. Because surely if they're loving us with the gospel, then we should be supporting them. So we're saying, okay, let the missionary have the money to live on. And again, I talked about there's other details here. I can't cover everything in one sitting. But let's realize that, folks, over there, we're idiots. In their cultural terms.
Is there not a sense in which, by definition, a missionary is always going to have feet in two worlds? I mean, the fact that you're sent from outside means automatically you're related to sending church somewhere, and that sets you apart completely from those that you're living with to begin with. And presumably there's also an understanding you'll never be a black African, I'll never be a, you know, no matter how long I live there, that's just not going to happen. So there's got to be an expectation from local people that you are an outsider, you are different, and there's nothing that can change that. And if I stay long enough in this society and I want to educate my kids, and those kids may or may not know the Lord, they may not want to live there forever, they're going to have to come home, so they have to have a baccalaureate, and so they have to go to a fee-paying school in wherever, and therefore I've got to have more funds than the guy next door. And I mean, that's just the world that we live in today. And are there not just a number of factors out there that, well, the intention has to be that we move towards these principles that we're talking about, but the reality is that the world is so globalized that that's just our lot.
Right, so I will never be an African, so I should never really expect to understand Africa. It's just not going to happen. And of course, the Africans who come to the West, we tell them, you'll never be a Westerner. We won't give you a decent job. You're just inferior. You don't get it. Actually, we make them president of the USA. So for an African to come here, we expect them to understand within months, and we want to push them into leadership. A European goes over there and they're ignorant for the rest of their lives. Sorry, I'm followed some of... Maybe I haven't answered...
It wasn't to say we shouldn't try and do whatever we can, but just the nature of the beast is we'll always be different. And people will always look at us and have expectations that we are different.
Right, and sure. I mean, the example I often give, say there's a wealthy Chinese businessman in Norwich City and his son comes and joins NCBC. Do we have a problem? He's mighty wealthy. Well, some people get jealous, but, you know, the 10th commandment says, covet not. So we take him, he becomes a part of NCBC, he might be a youth leader, whatever. And those who say, we can't have him here because his father's wealthy, we say, what's wrong with you? Now, the fact that he goes home and flies a helicopter back to China, is that my business? When he's in our community, in our church, take him as he is and allow him to do his own thing. People don't object. They know I'm a Brit. When they go back to Britain, Britain isn't heaven. It seems that way from Africa. It's nice for me to go back to the UK and to America and realise that actually there are problems over here. This isn't heaven. So yeah, of course you will have places we go back to. As we met the pastor today, he's signed on to be here for life. One day he'll leave and he'll go back to Leicester, wherever he comes from. That's okay, that's normal. One day I might leave Africa and I go back. That's normal. But when I'm there, am I always saying, British are better, English is better, I have money from home, or am I ready to say, I'll minister on the level with you folks? That's my prerogative. Not to try and drag them to me, but actually for me to go to them.
It seems, Jim, it's kind of a mindset. I think, Jean, you talked about you had a cross-cultural experience before you went to Cambodia, you lived with Cambodians. I think all my life I've been making cross-cultural leaps. I was a working-class kid from a little cotton town in Lancashire. Became a Christian in 19. That was a cross-cultural leap for me into the church. I had no idea what it was like. After a few years, my wife and I got involved with the Navigator, an American organisation. We started working with students. I left school with two O-levels. That was another cultural experience, learning to understand students. Then we were working in Birmingham, and in the 70s, the whole cultural shift in the student population in Britain happened, and we just weren't communicating anymore. So we came to Norwich, and I became a student at 40, to learn how to communicate with students who were secularized. So when I went to Africa, I'd already had about five cross-cultural experiences. And I think it's how do we train people to go, and to go with a mindset of not, right, I've come to tell you, but I've come to figure out how I can communicate the eternal message of Christ in a way that makes sense to you and your culture. And if you don't have that, the problem with the Victorians was they really did think they were civilizing the world. That was the problem.
I would suggest, Fred, the way is, if you go to people, I'm so humble, I want to learn from you, and you have £10,000 in your pocket, you've tied them. As we showed, they have to tell you what you want to hear. So it's contextualization is not what you do in the ivory tower, neither is it what you do by asking questions, neither is it what you do by spending hours and hours with the indigenous pastor. It comes as a result of vulnerability. And then they can push you and you move out of the way. You know, a missionary doesn't like to be pushed. He's the one with the power. Use their language. If you use English, that intricate thing they're trying to tell you they can't. Now again, I could have given illustrations, and I mean the one on language I used, I guess, was pretty graphic. They're trying to tell you about tennis using football speak, and you're just thinking, this fella's crazy. He's playing a game of football and he's taking a stick with netting in it to hit it with. That's just crazy, man. And of course he realizes that, he stops telling you, and he just tells you, well, actually we're playing football. They're not playing football, they're playing tennis. Use their language. Don't have the resources. Can there just be a few? We're not even saying everybody changed. Can there be a few who relate without foreign resources so that they're not constantly faced with this, please him, if you don't, I'm using a strong term, you're an idiot. You saw John shamed here as I was chatting to Pastor B. He turned me down. Who do you think he is? You know, I've got the resources. John learned that lesson. He never said no to a missionary again. Is that a learning curve? If you go to people and the bottom line is, I'm not going to say no. Let's see what pleases him.
Just a quick example to help drive that home. Many of us know patron-client. So the patron is the person who provides something and the client becomes loyal to whatever you are because they're getting resources. So just a quick example would be a Cambodian. I want to relate to them as at worldview level as possible, but I'm funding that person. I'm providing them a job, so that I'm paying them a salary, and I'm trying to relate to them at a true cultural level. And so that person says, oh, yes, I want to go to your church. I want Christianity. I want all of that, you know, and I'm giving him that salary. And then I leave the country. It means that your patron is gone. So you need another patron. So I'm gone, so you look around and you find a man and you strike up a relationship and they're paying you. They happen to be Mormon. And they start telling you about the Mormon doctrine and you start saying, yes, I want to become Mormon. How come he was Christian last month, but now this month he's Mormon? Because the resources. And so what happens is when you're trying to communicate and really express sincere communication back and forth with all of the hidden lies and things, once you enter your outside resources into that, relationships becomes fake and mysterious, and things are held back, and things are given. And that's why a man can go from Christianity to Mormonism in 2 months, because he was appealing to you. Yes, I'm a Christian. Yes, oh, I like, oh, hallelujah. Hallelujah. And then the next time, he's that quickly sold out. So I'm just saying that when you bring money into the relationship, there's a lot of lies in both ends, the codependency that's going on there.
Some really good people in Cambodia, American missionaries, planted a church in the countryside in the same province that we were living out in the countryside. They were there for 3 years, and the church slowly grew and grew. About year one, one of their elders came down with AIDS. And without telling people, but they started paying for antiretrovirals. No other assistance but just that. And 2 years on, the church continued to grow. And eventually she died anyway. And they didn't take up anyone else's, paying for anyone else's medicine. And the church dropped about 4/5 of its members because word had gotten out. And 6 months later, they left the country completely discouraged, and the church doesn't exist anymore. A very innocent mistake, not even a lot of money. And it's a bit of an extreme example, but it's not. It's reality. It's a real story. It really happens. It can be very subtle. But when you lead with money, huge consequences.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking out loud, really. Going back to what someone over there was saying about being outsiders and whether we can really relate when we're never going to be the people that we're relocating to. I'm sort of assuming that there is a role for people who relocate and there is a role for outsiders. And if it isn't the resources that we bring or the expertise that we bring, can we pin down what it is? As outsiders, do we bring a different perspective because we're not part of the dominant story? We don't come as a solution, but do we come to sort of just live out hope and be a sign? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think outsiders have a role, and it's good to have them. And I guess most folks in Norwich, oh, he's a visitor, and he's come from Qatar. We want to hear. Outsiders are innately interesting. What is he on about? Now, of course, the secular world struggles particularly with this question because they end up, it's either money or nothing. And that's why they go for the money. We have Christ. Yeah, how do you share Christ cross-culturally? Well, number one, use their language. Number two, don't buy all your ministry partners. Pray, read the Bible, trust God. And he's faithful.
Thanks very much, Jim. One lesson you can take home is with the net. When you're talking about the net in football, that's not the same as the stumps. Or is the stumps a net? Or is the goal the stumps, you know? Well, I was thinking in football and cricket, you can do the same thing. In fact, I love that particular metaphor because that's when you first told me about it. It was cricket and football and the fact they're incommensurable. Okay, I think we'd better go for a meal.